Welcome to Tech Weekly, the technology podcast from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski.
My favorite story about Steve is I shared a taxi ride to him when we opened our joint lab in Imria. And I was expecting him, in those days he was the business guy, to be asking me hard bottom line questions. We actually talked about Georges Gonthier's work because Steve is actually quite passionate about mathematics and he speaks French and he was in France and he wanted to know about French mathematics.
Ah oui, mais oui. Plus et minus. No, I'm terrible.
I love it when Americans speak French.
I'm terrible. I'm sorry to any French people who are listening. That was terrible. Ignore me. Anyway, that was Andrew Herbert, Managing Director of Microsoft Research, on meetings with Steve Ballmer. What do they have up their sleeves? Well, here to find out is Charles Arthur and Jemima Kish. Welcome to you both.
Hola.
Hola. So, Jemima, before we started recording this podcast, you mentioned an interesting something that I wanted to bring up. Do you weigh as much as a silverback gorilla?
Well, not quite. I went to London Zoo, and they have a "Are you as heavy as a gorilla?" thing, and I'm 80 kilograms with bun, but I'm not as much unless I stand on the scales with my boyfriend and his son.
So no, you're not quite
not quite that flipping big just yet. I've got 2 months.
More months and then perhaps.
Then we can set up the wrestling gig.
Charles, have you been anywhere interesting this week?
No, not really. I've just been messing around with scripts on my computer and things.
But you were spraying crops.
That's not very Guardian, is it, Charles?
Organically, with water.
I certainly hope so.
Hose-pipe ban.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of fabulous places to go, do keep your ears tuned to the podcast to find out where we're going, the next stop on our road trip, and how to join us. And on this week's show, finally, we're speaking with music wunderkind Spotify to find out how they managed to woo the music industry into giving them hundreds of thousands of tracks for people to hear themselves. Charles is heading to Cambridge to demand stuff from Microsoft. Like, real stuff, please. Is that right, Charles?
Real stuff.
Stuff, that's correct. We've also got quite a haul of feedback from you all. I mean, quite a haul of feedback from you all, particularly about Bobby's choice here. And we'll be delving into the greatest inventions that came from the hackers at last weekend's Yahoo Hack Day. And then there's the news. Holy cow, it is a hack show. Out of the ashes of the Pirate Bay peer-to-peer court case has emerged a whole lot of press about Spotify, a new streaming music service that the music bigwigs seem to actually like.
In a world where everyone loves music, introducing Spotify. Whatever you want.
Whenever you want.
Instant, simple, and free.
I feel all relaxed after that and sort of swaying a little bit. Jemima, you met with Paul Brown, the new UK managing director, of the music service. What happened?
Well, he was speaking at the Radio Reborn Festival, the Guardian conference recently. And I think he was there to be, you know, to prove that people that do stuff with technology aren't necessarily, you know, evil. But Spotify has had a huge amount of press recently, and there's a huge amount of interest in what they're doing. So I asked him if it's true that they're the future of music.
I don't think anyone can single-handedly be the saviour of the music industry. So I think we're a service that seems to be resonating with the consumer really well. I think it's a simple, straightforward service. And, you know, it's showing that the music really has a lot of power out there. And people seem to be liking it. But I think there's a lot of people out there trying to work out, you know, what the future of the industry is, not just us.
Have you got the numbers to sort of to back up being the saviour of the music industry as well? How many people are actually using Spotify now?
Can't disclose that, I'm afraid, at this stage. You know, it's a healthy uptake. As I say, I think we're not going to single-handedly be the saviour of the music industry. I think that's going to be a lot of people. But so far, so good. Very happy.
Now, you mentioned today that you very much think the way forward is a mixed model. One major part of Spotify's model is advertising. Isn't that a bit risky in the current climate?
I'd say in the current climate, everything's risky. I think advertising has been a a medium that's been there for 50 years, well, for longer. And so I don't think it's a risky medium at all. We're a new business, so we are entering the market. Sure, it's at a difficult time for the whole economy, but we've got a good team in place, and we I think with the user growth. And the popularity of the service and the engagement of users, then I think there's a business there. Plus, it's not just advertising. There are other pieces to the to the pie.
Now, the Spotify design, as many people have pointed out, is very, very like iTunes. And I think psychologically that's probably quite useful in encouraging wider take-up of the service, because it's a familiar format. But do you think it also helps perhaps with the kind of willingness to pay?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I obviously, I think any player, any music client, if you like, a music player, has, they all kind of, to me, have a similarity anyway. Ours is fairly simple and clean, but I've seen, I've seen others like Pandora that's pretty simple and clean. And so I don't think that alone is necessarily making people predisposed to act in a different way from a purchasing perspective. I think the simplicity of use around the what you call the operation, if you like, and the integration we've done with Seven Digital, for example, being able to click and buy and working to make that super, super simple. Ideally you want one click, right? And I think one of the things that Spotify has done, which people seem to love, is the whole playlist idea. So being able to share a link with you to the playlist that I want to share with you. So there's no track sharing going on, but I'm giving you that information. Being able to somehow, click and buy the playlist, it will drive sales ultimately. And I think buying tracks on their own to buying almost that kind of experience bundle of tracks gets really interesting and might actually be more money. So, there's a lot out there to play with, but so far the UI, the user interface and everything else seems to work quite nicely. We're happy so far.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the playlist, because that's really the most social element on the site at the moment. And when you look at, in some ways, rival services like Last.fm, as a user, I'm personally more interested in finding new music than I am listening to music that I already know about. Yeah. So when do you get those features?
I think, don't really have a total grasp on the roadmap yet. It's guarded very carefully in Sweden. I don't think we as a service necessarily will become kind of fully social in that way. They've done a great job themselves. I think you're right on the discovery aspect of things. I'm a bit of both. I love the fact that I can go and just things pop into your head and you can go and listen to stuff that guilty pleasures, etc. And then there's also the discovery element, which we have, but I think over time that will evolve too, which is buried in the service at the moment a bit.
It would be useful though if you could at least sort of import your taste or something into Spotify.
Yeah, well, remember, we're learning your tastes all the time from the data that we're compiling on you. So that's private data, wouldn't be disclosed in terms of anyone's identity or anything, but in terms of the user behavior, that will help us understand what you as a user would like to see, hear more of on the discovery side. So, again, it'll grow.
And other media, you mentioned that there may be the possibility in the future of sort of perhaps editorialising the music or adding video or other elements. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I can't tell you a huge amount, because ultimately any service potentially has those things down the pipe, in terms of the scope and the potential. Yes, we could do video. Yes, we could do more sort of editorial content. Right now, we're happy with what we've got, but I think, personally speaking, I think we can probably build on that over time. I don't think it'll be again going fully kind of social network type way, because I just don't think that's Spotify. I could be wrong, but I think that's the way it is. So I think it's about bringing in the right features at the right time, very much listening to our user base, which has only just really started growing and talking to us. So I think down the tracks.
Anything else we should keep an eye out for on Spotify? What's at the top of your to-do list?
Learn Swedish would be a good one. So I'm not the only. Well, they all speak fluent English, but anyway. At this stage, I think it's about More content. Watch, you know, we've got gaps and we're building on that. So watch out for, you know, your favourite stuff will be in there soon. You know, more exciting stuff to come in the subscription service as well. So hopefully any users out there, it's not just about the music. We'll be bringing lots of other stuff around the music.
That was Paul Brown, the UK Managing Director from Spotify, speaking with Jemima. Now, Jemima, can you tell me what other types of music services are out there? Not necessarily just like Spotify, because I think it's quite a unique system. But what other types of music services can people stream music or download music that are out there?
Okay, well, the two big differences are obviously streaming and downloading. iTunes has had the lion's share of the download market, but streaming, because it answers the free music problem, or the free music issue, is where a lot of the attention is now, because that's where they think they're really going to tackle piracy. And so there are lots of sites doing this. I mean, Last FM obviously has a radio bit, and there's We7 and a few other sites. But Spotify has very cleverly imitated the iTunes interface. And that's why they think it's a particularly kind of user-friendly version, even though you have to download an app, which is quite off-putting for some people.
Charles, it seems that Spotify it's got a business model that works for both the consumers and the music industry. Is that correct?
The business model isn't quite perfect. I mean, the idea is that, I mean, if you click on one of the song titles in Spotify, then if you sort of right-click or control-click on a Mac, then you get a thing which will say, buy it on iTunes, buy it on Amazon, except they're grayed out. You can't, you know, can't actually do it. But you can see that there's the idea there of having an affiliate link. I think there's been some talk about Spotify introducing a download service where you would actually buy it. The problem, of course, is there's been some ideas about doing it by ad funding and also by doing, you know, charging people out of the UK for access to it. The problem simply with adverts is, well, the market's not quite there and it's difficult to make people listen to them. When you're a streaming service, you have the problem of having to pay the PRS revenues. So as a model, I think that, you know, the music companies like it as long as they get their payment.
Well, one of our Twitter followers, Laughing Chance, actually says, he says it's a great service, but the ads are more than tolerable. Why should people pay?
They don't have to pay if the ads work. If they can get the ads, you know, enough ads, then and the ads are tolerable, that's actually the win-win, I think, you know, because everyone stays with the service and the advertisers get listened to. I think, you know, everyone would be happy if that's the case.
A bigger problem is that, obviously, when you download music, you can stick it on your iPod or your MP3 player and you can go and walk around and listen to it. And until we've got really comprehensive 3G or even, you know, a better network, 4G, that lets us use a service like Spotify and stream when we're mobile, it's only going to have limited potential. I mean, I do a lot of listening on my desktop, but I do more of it on my phone.
You can read up on Spotify on the website. Charles, we had a big feature in the paper about it recently, didn't we?
That was about the fact that Spotify was aiming to become one of the biggest players in this space, and that it's growing so quickly. It really has, you know, hit a million users in the snap of your fingers, really.
I've got an issue with Spotify because it tends not to have any of the music that I like to listen.
I think their genres are a bit lame. I clicked on New Wave thinking it would mean New Wave of New Wave, and no, it was playing me Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark.
OMD.
That's old wave.
I wasn't very
wave.
Impressed.
If you leave, don't leave now. Please don't. Anyway, I'll move
so
on.
So you're telling me there's no soul coughing on it?
There's no soul coughing on.
No, there's no soul coughing on.
No Green Day either. Any or Zappa. Anyway, I'll move on quickly. You can read up all about Spotify on the website, and that's guardian.co.uk/technology. In the meantime, here's Jemima with the news.
Carphone Warehouse finally confirmed its takeover of Tiscali in the UK, making it the country's largest residential broadband provider. Carphone paid £236 million for the business, which will give it 4.25 million customers. Google opted for old media to promote its Chrome web browser in the US, taking out its first TV ads. Google is desperate to push Chrome towards a mainstream audience. It garnered just 1.4% of the browser market since launch in September, while Internet Explorer has 66% and Firefox 22%. Facebook faces renewed scrutiny of its bizarrely indiscriminate censorship policies after Holocaust-denying discussion groups have been allowed to stay on the site. Meanwhile, photographs of breastfeeding babies remain banned and classed as obscene. Yahoo held its 8th Hack Day in London at the weekend, rolling out co-founder David Filo to inspire 250 hackers and tell them why the future of Yahoo is open. The winning hack was Open Freecycle by Prem and Tom, which made the stuff-sharing website more usable. And it included a grease monkey script that would stop you buying on eBay if the same product is on offer for free on Freecycle.
Thank you very much, Jemima. Our in-house Guardian technology hacker, Simon Willison, is in the studio. Welcome, Simon. Thank you very much for coming in.
Hello there.
So what happened on Hack Day, or as it's called now, Open Hack London?
So it was an interesting open hack. This was the first one that had been run by just Yahoo on their own. Previous years, the BBC had been involved as well. It was also a smaller event. I think there were around 250 hackers. But while it sort of seemed a bit quieter, it turned out towards the end that that's just because people had been working really, really hard. The quality of the hacks this year was absolutely astonishing. I think there were around 40 hacks in total, and they spanned the whole range from the sort of stuff that were just for fun to the things that were only of interest to developers, then up to the actual apps with a social conscience, which actually attempted to improve something about the world.
So when you talk about hacks, you're talking about different types of ways that the technology, specifically the Yahoo technology, can be used, or is it any
other
type?
Not necessarily. People could build pretty much anything they want. If you wanted to be in with the chance of a prize, it helped if you went with technologies from the hosting organizations. But that wasn't a requirement. And so while some of the hacks mixed together technologies and the sort of mashups of things that were available there, a lot of the hacks just built something interesting in 24 hours.
What were your three favorite hacks?
So three of my favorites. Open Freecycle has already been mentioned. That was a great example of an application with a social conscience. But one of the more fun hacks was the human-powered web browser. A bunch of guys hooked up a web browser to a pair of bongos and a scooter. So hitting the bongos would hit the back button, and the scooter, if they rolled it up and down the stage, it scrolled the scroll bar in the browser window. And that was pretty awesome.
I can't really see that scaling, though, unfortunately.
But possibly not. I was also, I got to take part in an iPhone orchestra arranged by Jim Purbrick, where we played the Doctor Who theme tune on 6 iPhones and a pair of Wii remotes, all wired up through Jim's laptop using a bunch of ad hoc wireless networking and sort of digital string and glue.
You were part of the team that brought out the open platform for The Guardian, and I was wondering if anybody used that to great effect Hack Day.
Yes, there were a few hacks that used the open platform. A lot of people used it to sort of add some headlines from The Guardian to their already existing hacks. It was a sort of token nod towards pulling in stuff from our API. But there was one hack in particular that was built entirely around our API, and that was kind of a satirical nod towards Yahoo's commercial problems and the recent shutdown of GeoCities. The hack was called Should I Back Up My? And what it would do is you'd enter the name of a Yahoo service. It would then search through The Guardian's recent archive of stories about that service. You'd put it through a sort of text analysis, try and figure out if it was positive or negative news. And if it was negative news, it would recommend that you sort of move your data off and back that stuff up right now. Funnily enough, that one didn't win any prizes, but it was a firm favorite with some of the audience members, I think.
Excellent. I love it. Well, thank you very much, Simon, for coming in. I'm sure we'll be speaking with you again in the future.
Sure.
As well as thanks to our listeners, by the way, for your support for the Guardian podcast nomination for the Webby Awards. The good news is that we won the Webby Award for podcast, for the Belief Stream, and also for newspaper, though it wasn't the listener's choice. So thanks, but no thanks, but thanks, if you know what I mean. Thank you very much. Hooray for us. We'll move on quickly. You can read up on all the news stories and not just the self-congratulatory ones on guardian.co.uk/technology. They work in a multi-gazillion pound building in beautiful Cambridge, creating the technology of our dreams. Microsoft Research Center is a kind of mecca for technologists, and now I know them from their excellent social psychological research, the analysis that looks at how we are who we are in online spaces, but they also make things as well. We sent Charles to the Fortress of Invention.
I'm standing outside the Roger Needham building at the University of Cambridge. It's Microsoft's research centre in the whole of the UK. It's a spring day, but there are literal and metaphorical clouds over the building. Microsoft yesterday announced it was going to cut 150 jobs in the UK as part of its widespread job cuts around the world. The question is Microsoft Research really useful?
You only need 4 different colours to be able to colour in the map in a way that you never have the same colour either side of the border.
Inside the lecture hall, it's Microsoft's annual Research Day when it shows off its work to journalists and researchers from around the world. It's an interesting place, and there's lots of work going on, but it's interesting also to see what sort of things never quite managed to get out of the laboratory. So I took a look at a couple of projects that are being worked on with Andrew Phillips, Richard Harper, and first of all, David Stone.
This is a demo of a program which can play the game Go. It's a system which can combine two techniques, a machine learning technique which uses pattern matching to predict what moves an expert player would make in a given position, and a known technique for playing Go called Monte Carlo Go.
What is that? What's Monte Carlo Go?
Monte Carlo Go works by playing simulated games from the current position until the very end of the game, and based on the outcome of those simulated games, determine statistics about how valuable the current position is, so you can make decisions about what move to make.
So basically it makes it a stronger player.
That's right. So the idea here is that the combination of the two things, the Monte Carlo technique and the pattern matching, should be stronger than either of the two techniques individually.
What's the value of this to Microsoft?
So I see Go as a valuable test set for machine learning techniques. Go is seen as one of the big challenges to AI at the moment, and maybe these ideas would generalise to other areas.
Richard, this is the whereabouts clock, which looks to me exactly like something out of Harry Potter.
We've written an application that runs on mobile networks and uses cell ID data to distinguish where each of these persons here you can see are. So this person's at school, this person's at work, these ones are at home. And when they're travelling between these places, the icon representing them goes into this area in the middle. When mum's icon left work, the kids at home watching the telly would say, ah, she's on her way home. And one of the things they could do is they, for example, could get off their Facebook accounts because they're going to be told off. Or they could put the kettle on. And then sometimes mum wouldn't come home in 10 minutes. She'd been longer than 10 minutes. So they only thought, ah, she's going to Tesco's. So she's going to be buying new cereals and biscuits. So let's be pleased when she comes home. Let's offer to help her. So what we found was that families actually use this little detail, refinement of knowledge that they already knew, to be a little bit more gracious about each other. We didn't expect that at all. We thought it would be issues about mums and dads and teenagers being monitored. It didn't come out at all.
Andrew, describe what it is that you've developed here.
So we're developing a visual programming language for biology. We're using it to build computer models of immune system processes in order to better understand how the immune system functions.
So it's the immune system processes rather than the actual molecules themselves.
That's right. I mean, we start by modeling the behavior of individual molecules. And then we run simulations to see how these molecules interact with each other over time in order to perform some kind of function, biological function.
And what does that tell you? When you run these simulations, what does it tell you about the way the immune system works? Because that's incredibly complicated, isn't it?
Well, it can tell you, for example, what happens when you change the behavior of a particular molecule, how that impacts on the overall, let's say, immune response. But more importantly, it can tell you why. So it can give you a way of generating hypotheses. So you can then get an understanding of how it works.
What's the value of this to Microsoft? Everyone thinks of it as a company which makes operating systems and office software.
At the most fundamental level, this is a programming language. And Microsoft has a number of languages it's been developing. It's based on solid work by others in the past on new languages for programs of massively parallel systems. So a lot of things happening at once. You've got a lot of proteins interacting. In the same way, you might have a lot of cores on your computer. So this is a parallel language. On another level, I mean, Microsoft is investing in software for the healthcare industry. So they're now investing in ways to improve the records, you know, patient records, making them more secure. But also, we might want to analyze that information at some point.
That's all clever stuff. Microsoft has here built things like the PhotoStitch software that can put together a panorama from a lot of photographs and drop people out of a photograph if you don't want to have them in it. But what real benefit is it bringing to Microsoft? I asked Rupert Goodwins of ZDNet, what he thought's the real value of Microsoft's Research Center here?
Well, it's extremely tax efficient, first and foremost. But Microsoft knows it has to have some new ideas from somewhere, and it'd much rather own those ideas from birth itself. So it's also a mark of corporate virility to have a really big R&D division. You can question how many of these ideas are going to end up in Microsoft products. In the past, very few of them have done. But you can't question the fact that they are doing proper research, it's being published, it's being part of the research community, and things are beginning to show up.
Why did you say tax efficient earlier?
because research is very tax efficient. If you're a big company with lots of money, you've got to invest it somewhere. And at one point, you can't buy up many companies. You can't pay the people writing software enormous amounts of money. You've got to do something. You have to do some research and development. And this is a very good way to spend your money. It makes you feel good. You do get some good stuff out of it. And it beats it sitting in a bank doing nothing.
Tax efficient. That's an interesting idea. If Microsoft is looking to make cuts, is it going to start cutting in the tax-efficient places, or is it just going to be cutting in the places that cost it money? I wondered about that. Andrew Herbert's the Managing Director of Microsoft Research in Cambridge, so I asked him whether his team is as important and whether they're facing cuts during this period of cutbacks all around.
Research as an organisation is still growing, particularly our lab in Cambridge, New England, and our research groups looking at data centres, and I'm replacing turnover in my laboratory this year.
How has the culture within the company changed? You said in your keynote speech that your researchers can do pretty much anything as long as you can then go and explain it to Steve Ballmer in a way that eventually will get him to smile. Is there a difference between Steve Ballmer and Bill Gates in terms of what sort of things will make them smile and how they reflect what sort of things they're interested in and not interested in?
They're different people, but I think the same things make them smile. My favourite story about Steve is I shared a taxi ride to him when we opened our joint lab in Imria, and I was expecting him, in those days he was the business guy, to be asking me hard bottom line questions. We actually talked about Georges Gonthier's work because Steve is actually quite passionate about mathematics and he speaks French and he was in France and he wanted to know about French mathematics.
And obviously if you have to take ideas to Steve Ballmer to try to make him smile, there must be some ideas that you simply tell your researchers, well, that's never going to fly. Can you tell us some of the things that you've had to knock back?
We don't really run the lab in that way. We're part of the academic system where peer review is the process by which things get encouraged, or things which don't work out so well get kind of diverted into new directions. So the kind of thing I look for when a new idea emerges here in the lab is someone comes up with the idea, they start doing things. Do others join in with them? Does it become something larger? If perhaps someone has been working on something for an extended period and it's not really got very much traction and others aren't interested, that's when I start asking questions. If you micromanage research, you kill it because you take the responsibility away from the researcher and they can then just blame the management for taking wrong decisions. If you leave them to take the decisions but mentor them in understanding what some of the questions might be, you challenge them both intellectually and thinking about what the impact of their research could be, as well as the academic excellence. They go figure.
That was Andrew Herbert from Microsoft Research Center. So Charles, if it's all tax efficient, will we ever see the fruits of their experiments?
Well, some of the things they've done there have actually gone out and been incorporated into Windows products. So some of the photo stitching software that you now see around, I did actually see being demonstrated when I was there 4 years ago in 2005. But there's other stuff which, has evidently just been going around and around in the spin cycle, basically. Some of the things just don't get out of there. So it sort of feels like, yeah, perhaps it is one of those sort of wonderfully tax-efficient things that only a very few little things ever escape out of the out of Cambridge.
And, of course, now that that their profits are down, what's going to happen with the R&D budget?
Well, the suggestion seemed to be that no jobs are being cut, that the budget stays much the same. Possibly there's a bit of a lag there, but Andrew Herbert seemed very confident that things were going to continue. Yeah, we'll see.
Very interesting to hear him say that you can't micromanage research, and I sort of wonder how much room they're given to go off and do their own thing. I mean, if they're not really given that many sort of deadlines to produce stuff, then it sounds like quite an amazing place to work if you can just go out there and, you know, just do what you want.
I think it is. It's pretty much the closest to a university that a commercial company will ever have.
Well, you can hear the extended interview with Andrew Herbert on our site. It's apparently more than very interesting, which is great.
I try.
Yeah,
I try.
Well done, Charles. Well done. You get a gold star. Anyway, it's available as a Tech Weekly extra at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. It's It has been a bumper fortnight for commentary from our listeners and readers. First, a correction. In last week's program, we heard an interview with Kane Kramer, who's the man who invented the digital audio player. At the start of the program, we mentioned that Kane had in the past called himself, quote, the world's biggest failure. He's asked us to explain that he didn't actually say that, and what he had said in the past is, or was that, quote, it is one of the UK's biggest failures. I suppose, in a way, the world's biggest failure. And that he was talking about difficulties for inventors to get support. Okay, well, let's hear the pulse on the blogs. Charles, what's been happening over on technology?
Well, there's been a lot. There's been a bug found in Windows 7. There's been a lawsuit against Apple over its MagSafe adapters for its laptops. But one of the interesting ones was that Eric Schmidt, who is a director on Apple and, of course, head of Google, has had the question of whether he should be the director of both and whether he should give up the Apple directorship. In the blog post, he's quoted saying that the possibility hadn't even crossed his mind, which led to various sort of back and forth on the comments. But of course, Swansong, I think, wrapped it all up really nicely with, "It all goes to show you can't be too careful." Which is, of course, the David Mitchell-inspired comment, where a few weeks ago the comedian David Mitchell wrote this marvellous piece in which he said, you know, I think all the comments on blogs, it's just ridiculous. I think what we should do is just go with the formula of, you know, just say, it all goes to show you can't be too careful. And he had something like 300 comments after his piece saying, it all goes to show you can't be too careful.
Oh, God. Oh, the hilarity of the internet. So funny. Well, over on the games blog, Keith was in search of a caption to a really, really terrible photo of Wolverine, you know, the character, Hugh Jackman's character. Activision basically have paid a substantial amount of money to put a terrible cardboard cutout of Hugh Jackman in with the Wolverine enclosure at Edinburgh Zoo for a year.
The Wolverine enclosure?
Yes.
Do you mean the wolf enclosure?
No, the Wolverine enclosure.
Oh, okay, right.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, he wrote a terrible caption for the terrible photo and then opened it up to the games bloggers to see if they could write better captions. And we had two cardboard-related captions. The first was from Smell-O-Vision. He offered Wolverine Origins Before Adamantium, which is a reference to the stuff that comes out of his fingers. And the only reason I know that is because I listen to Mark Kermode's podcast. Before Adamantium, bone. Before bone, cardboard. And Super Smashin continued with the cardboard theme. He said, cardboard given role in Wolverine 2, Jackman gutted. Which I think is quite funny. Jemima, what's happening over on PDA?
Hugh Jackman.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, moving on. We did a post just talking around a few issues about whether Twitter is killing. Don't look at me like that. He's nice. Whether Twitter is killing RSS readers. Not RSS as a technology, obviously, but just this is something that has... it's been bubbling along for a few months because a lot of people have noticed they're not using the RSS reader as much because they get kind of prioritized, socially contextualized links through Twitter. Steve Gilmore over on TechCrunch IT did a very nice post about this, saying that RSS readers had actually sort of detached people from the process of looking and exploring the internet, which is a really nice idea, and that Twitter is far more relevant. A lot of people didn't really agree with that exactly, and I think some people thought that he was talking about killing RSS, which obviously is, you know, more used than ever. It's specifically RSS readers. Tom One said that like me, he's one of those obsessive, greedy RSS readers or RSS users that has to go through every single headline and make sure you've read all of them. But he said this conversation is a bit misleading, don't you think? Because unless you follow more than 50 people and you check them every 10 minutes, there's no way you can keep up on Twitter. You're always going to miss things. And if you are one of those people that has to see every headline, as I am professionally obliged to do, then you can't keep up. But it's an interesting phenomenon. You might find TweetDeck will have an extra column added so that you could monitor, you know, maybe those kind of automated RSS feeds and keep them in a separate column to, you know, your proper conversations. But this one will run and run, I think.
I found a really interesting automated one the other day. It's called Notebot. This is for Twitter. And every time somebody says note to self, it retweets it. I think it's very funny. So you've got a really kind of funny series of notes. Anyway, you can get in on the conversations at guardian.co.uk/technology/blog/gamesblog. And digital content, I believe, is... /media/digital.
Guardian.co.uk/media/PDA.
Indeed. Well, our Facebook group was particularly vocal about the Susan Greenfield interview that you did, Jemima, a couple of weeks ago. David Stansfield wrote that he said, "Isn't the Baroness just suggesting what we've all heard before?" And this is with regard to her concerns with the physiological effects of social networking services. He says, "A balanced diet of Facebook, gaming, Twittering, and social interaction is good for you, but spending all day gaming or on Twitter is as undesirable as spending all day in the pub." Fair enough. I would say fair enough. You know, moderation, people, in everything you do. Alec Evans, on the other hand, wrote, "Just because someone is perceived as intelligent doesn't necessarily mean they have anything of import to say. Disproportionately focusing on what I know, handbags. Disproportionately focusing on one person view data point will always give you skewed evidence, as I think the Baroness has exemplified." So that's a very active conversation that's happening over on our Facebook feed. Our Flickr group has also been very, very active, particularly about Bobby's outfit for podcast recording. Bobby records in San Francisco where he lives, which means that he records early, early in the morning, and we record late, late in the evening. So a few weeks ago, we asked him what he wore, but not in a dirty way, when he records in his home studio. He took a picture in what he claims were his pajamas. Other people thought different. They said, Dipfan says, "Does having your hood up help the soundproofing?" Bobby says, and unfortunately he's not here, else he could do his own part, "No, it disguises the fact that I still have bedhead." On email, we will get to the end of this section, I promise. On email, one of our listeners insists on being a Luddite, though still listens to the tech podcast. Dave says, "Thanks for the podcast. I've just listened to last week's interview on the brain and social networking," which was the Susan Greenfield podcast we mentioned before. He says, "I was interested to hear how defensive some of you were about social networking, especially Bobby. I, for one, am not convinced that things like Twitter are anything but a bit of fun that has become fashionable and overused by celebrities, institutions, and businesses desperate for followers. For example, my college learning center library now uses Twitter, but I'm not quite sure what for. I shall be sticking to email, text, and phone for the time being." Finally, speaking of Twitter, as we have several times, "Thank you very much for the retweets from Mizeki and Nephilim and for the nice words from 6W. You can find out how to get in touch with us via any or all of these media on our website."
In this week's tech section with The Guardian, what's the right way to stop piracy? The answer, apparently, to ignore the little offenders. Find out more in this week's cover story. Newly Asked Questions finds out how much energy the internet's using. Rather a lot, it would seem, and it's growing very fast. The latest grade virals were based on a real one. When swine flu hit, games developers created versions quickly, within hours of the news. But what about the ethics? And while some people dream of climbing mountains, the British developers behind the Shadow Robot project dream of building a robot that can bring you a cup of tea. So far, they've built a hand. This and more in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
Well, that's it for this week. And for those who've been holding on this long to find out where we're heading in the next couple of weeks, it's Bristol. Jemima, do you have any more information about that?
Yes, very exciting. Loads of cool stuff going on in Bristol. We're just securing a venue, but it's definitely going to be in the afternoon of Friday, the 22nd of May. So you can come along and have a chat just before you break off for the bank holiday. But we're basically looking to speak to entrepreneurs, developers, designers, people doing interesting, creative, techie stuff in Bristol. We're going to meet in the centre of Bristol that afternoon. So keep an eye out on my Twitter feed, twitter.com/JemimaKish, obviously, and /GuardianTech. We'll put details up there as soon as we've confirmed them.
Excellent. So there's loads of stuff that's going to be happening out in Bristol, and that's on Friday, the 22nd of May. So if you've got anything going on, then let us know. And that is it. People, we are done. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you to our guests. Thank you to our contributors. to our producer who's over in the booth.
My mom.
Your mother. Yeah, I feel like
my dog, Mabel. She's got mad fun.
Anyway, I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next Tuesday.